Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are just a little bit embarrassed about having a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
Ben, I'm trying to marshal all of the energy I can because I know we're both a little under the weather.
Yeah, well, this is weird because I just saw you face-to-face yesterday, and now you're back in Seattle. I'm stuck down here in L.A.
Mistakes were made.
And we could have recorded together yesterday, or you could have just stayed over a day and we could have recorded in person.
No, but, I wasn't going to do that.
Boy, yeah, we did a lot of dumb shit yesterday.
Yeah, I was down there on one of, I'm sure, it's going to be the first of 50 visits to Los Angeles to look for a place where my wife and I can live. And you really stepped up in the friend zone, Ben. I know there's no chance of a relationship between us. So when you're friend zoned by Ben, it means being driven around by Ben to see places that you might want to live.
Listen, I know you want a little bit more than just being driven around by me all day. But that's not where I'm prepared to go with you, Adam.
Yeah. So what I thought was going to be a visit to see a number of places ended up being a visit to see one and then get day drunk on a patio right after.
Yeah.
Which is what we did.
We had a couple of restaurant options that we were exploring the idea of going to, because part of the idea was like get a sense of the Los Angeles neighborhoods that you and your wife are considering.
Right.
And see whether or not one or another feels like the best option to you. So we went to a restaurant that was like weirdly desolate in the middle of the day, despite being by a sort of buzz, like it's a restaurant with a buzzy chef in charge of it. But yeah, the lunch service, like I walked in and like there were literally no people apparently working at the restaurant.
It was a bad sign.
Nobody behind the bar, nobody at the hostess stand, no servers walking around, no bussers, no nothing. And so I just took a flyer and went and seated myself at one of the zillion empty tables, and our server was very nice. When she saw that she had a new customer, she apologized profusely for not having been around when I first came in, and then brought over menus. Yeah, that should have been the red flag that deterred us from eating there.
But there was a green flag in the form of bottomless rum punch.
Yeah,
and that I think really made us feel differently about the restaurant at that point. So we had one of those lunches that you and I occasionally have where we just feast on appetizers and a bunch of cocktails.
Yeah.
And the red flags multiplied at this point because we ordered, I think, six different things and they came out almost immediately and all of them about room temperature.
Yeah, like we ordered buffalo wings and nachos and calamari and fish and chips, and none of it seemed hot.
Yeah, that did not prevent the grind because I know both of us went to town pretty hard on these apps.
I don't know if this happens to you, but I kind of have like the great white shark thing of like my eyes roll over white and I just eat until I can't eat anymore when I get to a... When I'm in a situation like that, and then I think back and I'm like, oh, I made poor choices, but I'm never able to like in the moment go like, huh, the fact that this huge plate of nachos, the size of a fucking hubcap, is not hot, and yet we just ordered it like 3 minutes ago, is extremely suspicious.
Yeah, we should have hit the brakes on this thing right then and there, but you and I were in a festive spirit. We decided to call it the Uxbridge Shimoda Holiday Party.
Right, which will date this episode, but yeah. that's when this happened.
Yeah, and so we decided to lean into the drinks, and then we quickly realized that we were 90 minutes away from the airport.
Yeah.
Given the traffic, and so we safely, responsibly got on the road and went to the airport after this. And
yeah, I had knocked it off with the bottomless punches quite a bit ahead of realizing this. But like, we were kind of luxuriating in our afternoon, and I was like, oh, just on an off chance, I'll see what the map says is going to be travel time to get you back to the airport. And we're like, oh shit, we got to go right now.
I think any drive long enough to necessitate a stop to pee qualifies as a road trip.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's what it was. When you drive from the west side to Burbank, that was a road trip, Ben.
Yeah.
Nearly all afternoon was spent in the car.
Yeah, and very little highway time. Like, we spent like a very small amount of the end of the trip on a highway, but mostly it was surface streets across town because so many of Los Angeles's drivers had managed to pilot their cars into each other that day, and the highways were all tied up.
Since deciding to move to Los Angeles, I visited LA several times, and each time I'm treating it as like a simulator, right? Like, this is what it's like to live here, this is what it's like to drive here. And that was a real eye-opener.
Yeah, the company was very pleasant, but yeah, that was a long drive, and long enough that, like, I mean, I would have guessed eating food that was bad, I would have started to feel it in the car, but I really didn't. I got home, I took the dog for a walk. I took the dog for like a 45-minute walk. I decided I was too tuckered out to cook, so I ordered a pizza for me and my wife to eat. And then I plopped myself down on the couch and started watching an episode of The Expanse. And like, over the course of like half, it was like the last half of an episode that I was finishing up. And over the course of that like 20 minutes, I went from feeling tired but fine to like, oh boy, I'm not going to eat dinner. I feel totally disgusting.
Whoa. Yeah, this was something that alarmed me on the plane, because I got a text from you that was like, hey, bud, you feeling okay? And I was like, in my mind, I was like, never. No. Like, you'll have to be more specific. And you had mentioned that you thought the food had made you sick. And this was alarming to me, because once I get it in my head that there is a possibility of this, like, this happened before to me, where like, yeah, I will have gone out to a meal with someone, the other person is sick, and they're like, hey bud, how are you feeling? Yeah. I feel like you can the secret this and make yourself sick by dwelling on it. And I was on an airplane and I was like, oh God, I need to stop thinking about how my stomach is feeling.
Yeah.
Because I thought that I would make it happen.
Well, I feel like you're also, your baseline with your GI is already so, has already so much strife that,
yeah, but no one's shitting in a barf bag.
Yeah, I
there are rules.
I barfed, man. I'm gonna tell you, I at a certain point, my wife got home, she was tucking into that pizza, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't be in the same room as it. And
did she push open the bathroom door and she was like, get it, player? Oh shit, that reminds me of a story I gotta tell you.
Yeah, you gotta tell me what that means.
So over the, God, this, we're going to date the episode again, because last weekend I have an annual dinner hang with my closest friends where we go out for a nice.
Oh, your closest friends. My invitation must have gotten lost in the mail.
I should say my closest local friends. We try to find a dark restaurant with a booth where we have a big meal. A big meal of meat and a baked potato and a couple of martinis, like that kind of dinner.
Yeah.
And then we spend the rest of the night going out and catching up and having a good time. And this is what we did last weekend. And
this is your annual reindeer run, I believe. I've heard you call it.
Yeah, it's an occasion I look forward to every year.
Yeah.
Because there's always a story that happens. And yeah, this time was no different.
Did you get the reindeer runs?
Oh, I've had the reindeer runs all day today, because that's how my pico patio meal manifests itself in my body. So it's like the third stop on this reindeer run. Like, it's well after dinner and it's closer to midnight. It's definitely like the drunk hour at around midnight. And and it's time to hit the bathroom. So I'm in there, and it's one of those, it's one of those bathrooms with one urinal and one bathroom stall and one sink. So there's no lock on the door. You just go in and use what's open. And if nothing's open, you're queued up.
Yeah. Men's rooms are a real horror show.
So I walk in and it looks empty. So I walk up to the urinal and I begin my business. And because I'm drunk, it is a long bit of business. I'm in there and I can hear a guy make himself known in the stall, through the violent sounds of his vomit. Like it was quiet momentarily. You know, a lot of times you'll go into a public restroom and like you'll get the courtesy cough from the stall that sort of announces, hey, you're not in here alone.
Right.
Try to keep it down with your business. Like that's sort of what I experience.
I love that. That's like the most humane thing you can do.
This guy was giving me courtesy vomit. And he was in there really going to town on this toilet. And so I'm in there and I'm like, I would love to leave, but I'm like in mid pee and a drunk pee is lasting a long time. So yeah. I'm in there doing the thing. The door opens behind me. And keep in mind, all of this is unseen. I'm looking at the tile wall and just hearing. Behind me, I hear step, 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 and then the sound of the stall door opening. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, oh no, the guy didn't lock the stall. I hear a guy open the stall door and he's like, whoa, get it, player. And I can't hold back. I am laughing so hard at this moment. Get it, player.
Get it, player.
And I finish up. I don't make eye contact with get it, player guy. I walk up to the sink. I wash my hands and I walk out. And I am just dying about get it, player. So I go out to my friends and like it's a booth situated where like you can see who's coming out the bathroom and when. A moment later, guy wearing a sequined red suit walks out. This is the barfer. This is the player.
The player is in the sequin.
And in one unbroken motion, his name is called at karaoke. I failed to mention that this is a karaoke bar. He walks right up to the mic and sings terribly. He gets the gavel song of the night. Last song of the night, closing time, was him.
Wow.
He ended the night going from toilet to mic.
Did he Outkast Player's Ball? As his song.
I will tell you that his rendition of the song that I can't remember was so awful that he was close to getting booed off the stage.
Wow.
Like it was like scream slur singing. It was just really bad.
Karaoke runner though. Like
I wanted him to dominate. I was rooting for him.
Most karaoke bars have a couple of ringers that they bring in to set a level. And this is the person you want to close with. Like you either close with that person or you pick somebody that's really hitting dingers among the civilians and ask them to close it, right?
Look, man, I think you know me. I think you know I do my best not to judge people for how they look. I try to walk a mile in another person's shoes before coming to any sort of judgment about the guy. But you see a man.
Or a sequin suit.
You see a man in a red sequin suit, and I think the safe assumption is... probably pretty good at karaoke.
Yeah.
This guy died out there, Ben.
Wow. Maybe his vocal cords were fried by all the bile that had run across them moments before.
I think that totally checks out. I think he shredded his cords on that bathroom floor and was unable to get it at the microphone.
Yeah.
And so that was that.
That player got it elsewhere.
Anyway... forevermore, get it, player, is going to be a thing I want to say in moments where other people are vomiting.
Yeah. Wow.
Or metaphorically vomiting.
I was that player last night, and I'm sorry to hear that your butt was that player today.
Yeah, it's been a tough day all around, but really happy to have had an impromptu visit with you for a day. That was fun.
Yeah, that was super fun. And looking forward to that being a little bit more of a regular thing.
Yeah, Yeah, me too. Hopefully it won't mean our show and our friendship goes down in a blaze of glory.
Right? Oh, snap.
I may be butt sick, Ben, but I'm still well enough to dispense with a world-class pivot to show. I'm a professional.
Yeah, you really are. Do you want to hit it? Do you want to get into today's episode, season 5, episode 23, Blaze of Glory?
Ben, it's only the second Star Trek episode ever to be named after a Bon Jovi song. Of course, the first was The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry. That was a B-side off of Slippery When Wet.
Mm.
Never really went anywhere.
Mm.
I think the title did itself an injustice there.
Yeah, the music directors at radio stations just weren't into that one.
Yeah.
But, do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
Speaking of calamari, Adam.
Oh, yeah.
This episode opens with Rom shoving some dubious calamari in his mouth and announcing that squid is his favorite human food.
Mmm, delicious, sir.
I think this is a perfect food for a Ferengi to like.
It makes me re-evaluate all of the other foods we've heard about them eating, because calamari is one of my favorite human foods as well.
Yeah.
I love calamari.
It's good.
I love it fried. I love it sautéed. I love it in pasta. It's delicious.
It's a guilty food for me.
So maybe,
as I've stated before, I think cephalopods are aliens, and I think they deserve our respect.
Poor bastards rain down on us from another dimension, probably just as confused as we are.
Maybe all that shit that the Ferengis are always eating, like, you know, beetles and the snail juice and stuff, maybe that's all delicious.
Yeah, maybe we'd like that.
We don't know
how you'd like that.
The stuff on Ferenginar is probably great. They're The Ferengis are bon vivants. They want to be rich and have, like, nice shit, you know?
Fucking Jake does a spit take with his pasta, with his calamari dinner, because the sauce is a slurry of tube grubs.
That's a bad look, Jake.
You know he was a racist.
Like, it's fine to be a picky eater, but if you've already tasted it and liked it, get over your shit.
There's also a 0% chance that he's never had tube grubs before, right? Because when you're best friends with a person and that person has a favorite food that is something like tube grubs, you have to have tried it, right? If you liked something that I had never had before, I'd have to try that.
You'd give it a try. You'd come to it with an open mind.
Right. Right. But Jake here is going to the napkin with this bite and pushes his plate away.
I thought it was interesting that Ben Sisko prepared such a beige plate for these kids.
Yeah.
That
seems unlike him.
It's this guy is steeped in the cuisine of the Creoles, and he's making a beige plate.
When you talk about it, it just makes the juices run in my mouth. I mean, it's just exciting to eat.
I don't see it. I think he would have more colorful ingredients on that plate.
I don't want to come down too hard on Jake as the only Sisko not eating well here. I'm not seeing Captain Sisko raise a fork up to his mouth very often in this scene, do you?
No, but he's a chef, man. He probably tasted it all the way through.
I just wonder if this is dare food and this is a bit that he's doing, you know?
Is this the time in the late 90s when reality TV really exploded and, like, Fear Factor became a thing?
Yeah.
Maggoty fried chicken and worm potato salad.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Maybe that's what's going on.
Captain Sisko's favorite podcaster is Joe Rogan.
Yeah, yeah, he fucking loves that shit.
Pretty interesting B story first here, right?
Yeah, Nog is there, you know, partly as Jake's pal, but partly as the cadet on the station. And it's one of those, like, he does a great job of playing it off like this is not something that he wants to bring up to the captain, but really it's clearly an issue that is weighing heavily on him. He's rotating through working with the security team on the station and has had a few encounters with Klingons that leads him to believe that they are rude dudes with bad toots.
I really like the feeling of a professional relationship and a social relationship playing out at the same table. This is hard stuff for Nog, because he's wearing the uniform. The captain has invited him to dinner, but he's got a social relationship with Jake, and he's trying to juggle those two things. Like, I don't think it's any accident that he's sitting between Jake and Ben Sisko at the table. Like, he's being pulled in both directions like that.
It's very interesting, sir.
This is another Kim Friedman episode, and I think that that's super intentional. And it also really reminded me of that scene a couple episodes where he was stuck between Worf and Martok. And and that is clearly like what is being referenced here, this idea that he is sort of invisible to the Klingons in a certain way. And that's, you know, you can't perform a police action on somebody that doesn't acknowledge your presence.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, is that how I should try to get out of a ticket? Just like hands on the wheel, looking straight ahead, just ignoring an officer screaming through my window?
Yeah, I think that's
the way to
do
it. That'd work out great for me, right?
Yeah. Just roll up the window on your Cybertruck.
Yeah.
It's unbreakable, Adam.
Not bad.
Nog is describing Klingons like a high schooler talking about the varsity football team, right?
Yeah.
Like there's a caste system on the station where the Klingons are the rough and tumble, scary guys. And to Nog, that's really difficult. He's in a position of authority, but he has no authority if it's not recognized.
He's the hall monitor that gets pantsed and doesn't get to enforce his hall monitor power.
The reason the comparison is apt is because Sisko treats it and Nog to anti-bullying advice that we're used to hearing today. You know, you just need to stand up for yourself.
Right.
You can't just get like shoved into your locker. You got to shove back. They'll never respect you.
We get an object lesson in this disrespect when General Martok walks in and hands Sisko an iPhone and tells Jake and Nog just to clear right out. And it's clearly like an adults are talking now, boys. Get out of here.
Yeah. I wonder if Martok would like to get down on this calamari and tube grub situation.
I feel like he'd be into it. He might resent the fact that it's cooked.
Yeah. Yeah, you know he's down with tentacles.
Yeah.
But only if they're moving.
Is that what's nice about running a Klingon restaurant, is that there's not that much work involved?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the food safety standards have got to be so different.
Yeah. It's just keeping it all alive is basically the main thing.
I love how Martok hands Captain Sisko the iPhone here, and Captain Sisko's like, what am I looking at? I need this decoded. And Martok's like, oh yeah, sorry. And then he puts his thumb on it, and then it unscrambles the message. This message is from the Maquis.
Maquis?
Because while on patrol, he intercepted it.
Yep, it's a woman addressing someone named Michael, saying the missiles are launched, they're heading toward Cardassia, and this is our final attack.
The release of nuclear weapons has been authorized. This is not a drill.
13 days is how long it will take these missiles to strike Cardassia. And Martok, upon hearing this, is like, yeah, that's pretty awkward, because there was a time where I remember selling cloaking technology to the Maquis, so pretty sure those missiles are going to be cloaked.
You see the problem.
What an interesting idea, like delivering arms to a force that doesn't really hold the same values as you just because it's politically expedient at the time, and that coming back to bite you in the ass a little while later.
Except there's no, like, Martok drops this bomb in the room and Sisko's like, cool, well, we got to solve this problem. He should be pissed at Martok, right?
It does seem like a bit of a pass because, the issue is that the it's missiles and cloaking devices, and the speculation is that these two devices could have been married, and the Maquis had access to all of these WMDs that could mean if a cloaked missile hits Cardassia, we're talking about millions of dead in the initial attack, and then the Dominion striking back at the Klingons and the Federation, the Federation being the proxies for the Maquis and the Klingons having sold them the arms, they could be punished by the Dominion to the tune of billions of lives. We're talking about a war on a scale of billions of lives here.
I mean, no one could have guessed that that separately yellow cake uranium and tubes could be combined to form cloaked missiles here. The idea of a cloaked missile is extremely interesting, and the first time that we're hearing of such a combination.
It's a hell of a combination.
To the degree that I sort of felt like this was a this will change everything kind of technology that, not to skip to the end too much, like, is not realized.
Yeah. I forget exactly what the storyline is of it, but there's an episode of Voyager where there's like a crazy super weapon that they have to find and disarm that really reminded me of.
I mean, if cloaked missiles have been around from the start, you could change the storyline of every Starfleet battle in history.
Yeah. I wonder if it's kind of, there's a bunch of discussion of the cloaking device on the little D in this episode and the fact that it isn't that effective because it's so overpowered. And a missile is basically an engine with a small payload on it. So maybe it has the same issue, that the cloaking device is like, it makes it harder to find, but not impossible.
You know, I was thinking a long time during this episode about why they kept ringing that bell about the little D's engines being unable to be covered up by its cloak, and that's got to be it, right?
Right, because the little D doesn't really factor in that much in this episode.
Not at all.
It's a runabout episode.
That's pretty great that we can draw a line between those two things. I think that's good writing.
Goldacott.
The cut.
Goldacott.
So...
So they have a little McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
In ops with Worf, O'Brien, and Dax talking to Sisko about how tricky it is to find this.
It's like a Ligurian mastodon moving through the forest. You may not be able to see it, but it definitely makes the leaves rustle.
I need answers, people.
The idea is that they need to find where they were launched from to disarm them remotely, basically, because the clock is ticking. They've got 11 days left. So apparently, Sisko got this news and took the weekend off.
Look, I signed up for this Ferengi cooking class, and I mean, it's really hard to get into.
Yeah. And, you know, frankly, some of the ingredients were not that fresh, so I've been on the shitter for 2 days.
Oh, yeah, this timeline, you gotta hold this timeline together, right?
Yeah.
I think I know someone who can help.
I loved this this space station that they cut to.
Oh, yeah, the Eddington has been locked up on Space Prison Regular One, right?
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I like the way they backlight it. Looks dope.
Yeah, I wonder why the shows don't pull more footage from the movies this way.
I think you've got to be judicious or you'll get caught, you know?
I mean, the one thing you and I have said before about like the main thing about Star Trek is how efficient it is.
Yeah, it's very cost-efficient television. Yeah. The cell that Eddington is in is very reminiscent of the ones on the Starship Enterprise, and the case is made that Eddington is just as dangerous behind force fields as he is out in the world. But he takes a look at this iPad and watches the video just for a second. He doesn't admit to being the Michael that this woman is addressing right off the bat.
No, because Eddington has the vibe of a guy who is super happy to be where he is. He's going to run out the clock on his life, and that's going to be it.
Right, and he believes that means, like whenever the Dominion decides to attack, like, they'll just kill him when they get here.
I got some real Rambo 2 vibes from this moment, because like John Rambo at the beginning of that film, he's in prison also.
Yeah.
And that makes Sisko the Troutman in this moment. And it's like, hey, how'd you like to get out of here? I could maybe even get you a pardon if you help us track down these missiles.
Would you rather be locked up in a room or in a labor camp breaking rocks with a sledgehammer if you were locked up?
I think I'd rather be breaking rocks.
It seems more tempting, right? Like you're outside.
Want to get some fresh air.
You're getting some exercise.
You're getting pretty ripped.
Yeah.
Which I think is good.
Rambo's stacked at the beginning of that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. But Eddington does not find any appeal in a full pardon. He turns it down.
Yeah.
He turns it all down.
And this is interesting because Sisko's saying, like, you know, if this happens, like, a billion humans are going to die too. Like, don't you want to save people's lives? And he is really like devil may care, fuck you. I don't give a shit.
I used up all my tears when the Dominion slaughtered the Maquis.
Maquis?
If it hasn't been said before, it is a total, like, mutually assured destruction scenario that they're facing, because if these missiles hit Cardassia, the retaliatory attack by Cardassia would be such that it would wipe out the whole Federation.
Yeah. This is one of two long conversations between these two guys in this episode where they hit the ball back and forth a lot. And, you know, eventually Eddington starts to let on that he knows quite a bit about the missiles and, you know, the abort codes and stuff, but that he's not going to do anything about it. Like he goes from, I don't know what this is or who this woman is, to, yeah, I know about the missiles, but you're never going to find the launch site. There's nothing you can do. And eventually starts, like, kind of psychoanalyzing Sisko and making the case that Sisko's tripping on the fact that he can kind of decide the fate of the entire quadrant if he does this.
I mean, and this is a trope that we see quite a lot in television and film, the guy in the jail cell having all of the power.
Yeah, infuriatingly so.
That's not very damn funny.
Back on Deep Space Nine, Quark is in the infirmary with a head wound that he sustained from a nude Morn.
He's got to watch where he's swinging that hammer.
I don't really understand when or where Morn got nude, but he also ran into the Bajoran temple nude, and Kira got an eyeful of that hammer.
Yeah, I think Kira's worshiping another god now.
Yeah. Thou shalt worship false idols.
Yeah.
Odo is kind of drilling Quark like this is all his fault. Like he provoked Morn into doing this. And so Quark is like recounting the conversation.
I'm the victim here.
He's saying like, oh yeah, I was explaining how like when this station becomes like the front line of the war between the Federation and the Dominion, we're all going to die. And that doesn't seem like something you can get in trouble for, right?
No, not at all.
Quark is right in this, that he was engaging in some speculation, and that's fine.
It's not like yelling fire in a movie theater. He's just telling a bar buddy what's possibly going to happen in the coming weeks and months.
But it does give a sense of like how on edge everybody is.
Interesting that Morn's instinct was to strip. He doesn't want to die clothed.
He doesn't want to die without his main weapon easily at hand.
Yeah. He died the way that he lived. With a great big crank.
Did he die?
No, I'm like projecting into the future. Like if Deep Space Nine were attacked and destroyed, how do you eulogize Morn? A naked, dead Morn.
I guess that's right.
Ben, this scene is an example of turning a one-minute conversation into a five-minute conversation. It felt very stretchy to me, you know? Like if this is a fairly breathless episode with a lot of action set pieces and stuff, but if there's any fat in it, it's definitely here, I think.
It's a weird, like, it's a C story that is one scene long.
Yeah, and it's a lot of, like, Morn did what? Morn did what? But he also did this. He did that?
I don't have the faintest idea.
Yeah, I mean, but how else are Quark and Odo going to be in the episode?
Yeah, that's true.
I think it's honestly like an ensemble cast problem. Like they keep doing these episodes that are like one person off on an adventure, and they're coming up with increasingly implausible ways to write the other characters into the show.
It's a paycheck wagging the story dog.
I think it is.
Yeah. You're going to get paid anyway. Got to use them. The scene ends with Kira being called up to ops by Dax because there's an incoming FaceTime from Sisko. Sisko's saying he's going into the Badlands. He doesn't need the little D because what he's got is Eddington.
Yeah.
And then he sort of like does that dramatic reveal over his shoulder. He's in a runabout with Eddington and they're going on a road trip.
Yep.
They're going to Burbank.
They're going to Burbank. They're going to drive through all of Beverly Hills and the Hollywood Hills to get there.
Yeah, those are the Badlands, right? Sawtoothing through Beverly Hills and the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah. I loved that their in-flight meal was served on an in-flight meal size plate.
Perfect. Yeah, that was fun.
And they're like doing bits on replicator food.
What's the deal with airplane peanuts?
This is the first I feel like we've seen that makes the case that the Maquis eat better than Starfleet.
Yeah. Yeah, Eddington makes the case that the Maquis are like farm to table types, like, and really annoying about it too. Sisko, you would never know what an ancient grain tastes like.
The complexity of flavor is something that you can only imagine.
Have you ever eaten an heirloom tomato?
Picked it right off the vine. It's still warm from the sun.
I did like all this backstory about, like, you know, you're eating the same protein. It's just in the shape of different stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't taste like anything to Eddington.
Yeah. Like the way that like fondant doesn't taste like anything interesting, even if it's shaped like a flower or something on a cake, right?
Right. You can make your birthday cake look like a hamburger all you want. It's still going to be a shitty sponge cake covered in fondant.
Exactly. It made me wonder if the plate was edible.
Mm.
Like in a taco salad kind of parlance.
It came out of the replicator. Might as well be.
Why wouldn't it all be protein?
I don't know.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pail. A bucket. A pail. Mr. Bucket, I have to revert back to my little state.
Eddington, he really knows Ben Sisko's buttons because he evokes the name of Cal Hudson in this scene, who he mentions was killed fighting the Cardassians. And the look on Ben Sisko's face is pretty devastated.
It is a senseless and sad death for a guy that Ben Sisko still clearly really loves despite the fact of his betrayal.
They have another of many great conversations in this scene. And what the big takeaway here is that they are more alike than different in their leadership strategy. Eddington says that Sisko's deal with him is personal and not professional, and that he just can't get over the fact that Eddington and Cal Hudson chose Team Maquis. And this is the same case that Sisko makes against Eddington, that you're like a leader that's sort of a cult of personality guy. Like, and that's why you love being the leader of the Maquis, is like you get these people to follow you.
Right. You do this in spite of what it represents, not because of what it represents. And and conversely, Eddington saying that Sisko hates the Maquis because they represent a flaw in his worldview rather than him actually disagreeing with any of their particular arguments.
Right. And then Sisko does that thing that, like, here's how you win an argument. You say something to the degree of, all of this is your fault anyway. Because what Sisko says is, like, the torpedo crisis is on Eddington.
Yeah. And that Eddington gassed up the Maquis to think that they could actually win, that they could actually become this, like, sovereign nation, when it was always a foregone conclusion that the Cardassians would cream them if they weren't under the protection of the Federation.
And the whole reason that the Cardassians partnered with the Dominion is because of the Maquis.
You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
This is a heavy trip, right? Because, like, the war that they're talking about is, I mean, like the Dominion War is the thing that people talk about with Deep Space Nine. We know it's coming. And
yeah,
this kind of makes the case that it was an avoidable conflict.
Yeah. You can tell that Eddington really feels it. Like, it stops the argument in its tracks and he just has to turn away.
It's a great scene. It's a long scene. It's not one of those scenes where two characters come in needing two different things and resolve conflict. Like, the conflicts change and morph. And when you think Eddington is out of the conflict, periodically, like, Sisko will rise to change what the conflict is.
Yeah.
It's real fun. It's very similar to the scene when Eddington is in jail in that way. And I really liked both of these scenes a lot.
I think Kenneth Marshall as Eddington is great in this episode. I think he's always been really good, but it's got to be so hard to go toe to toe with Avery Brooks.
Yeah.
As an actor, because there's just I feel like you want to rise to the occasion of acting with Avery Brooks, and this is very much a stage play setup. You're inside a runabout, you're arguing your side, and I don't know how you do that when you're faced with him, when you're faced with Avery Brooks, you know?
Right.
He's like made for this in a way that, as good as Kenneth Marshall is, I think you're really trying to be better than you're usually asked to be, and I think he is in this ep.
Yeah, and I think that Avery Brooks has that reputation as being a very generous scene partner. So,
yeah,
it's great, great scene.
So shines a good deed in a weary world.
In the B storyline, Nog and Jake are hanging out in Quark's. This may be the first time that we've been in Quark's since Quark got all the stickers removed from his door.
Oh, yeah,
he's no longer condemned, but the Klingons are really making a lot of noise, and Nog
they're over at the golden headbutt machine.
Yeah. Nog can reckon the amount of decibels they're generating just by sitting there listening to them.
Yeah. That's pretty wild power.
Yeah. And he's just waiting for them to go over the legal limit so that he can go arrest all of them.
They won't respect me until I stand up to them.
And the second they do, he falls backward in his chair and is stricken with embarrassment. He's very embarrassed, Adam.
I think if you fall backwards in your chair at a bar, you've got to get right up, right? I think it's a race against time at that point. But he chooses to remain on the ground.
I went to a dinner party once where a guy's chair collapsed under him.
Oof.
That was a tough moment, you know? He felt.
Was that a wooden chair?
It was a wooden chair, and it was, you know, like, it wasn't because he was too heavy. It was because the chair gave way. It was like a bad chair, but he
felt.
That's
the thing, though. No one thinks that.
Yeah, he felt.
Everyone's going to think that you're too heavy.
Yeah.
When the chair breaks.
Yeah. I mean, you treat it as a wake-up call or whatever, and hit the gym. You know, whether or not it was your fault, maybe it can have a positive outcome, but it doesn't feel good in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing we know about Nog from previous episodes is that he's working out with shake weights. He's getting pretty jacked. He's maybe living that, that Jim Shimoda lifestyle.
Maybe he
has put on muscle weight to the extent that the chairs in Quark's bar can't hold him.
I've been working out. I'm huge.
He doesn't even know his own center of balance. But shouldn't he be able to do that like wide receiver thing where he like gets up without putting his hands on the ground?
Oh, yeah.
He, like, kicks his feet out and stands up.
One would think.
That would be cool. That would have been fun to see.
Yeah. Yeah, if you work security, you must be trained in combat, right? Like, when you learn martial arts, you practice falling a lot. And clearly, that's not how he's been trained, based on what we see here.
On the runabout, they arrive in the Badlands, and pretty quickly are set upon by a couple of Jem'Hadar warships, and Sisko starts running something from the Ben Sisko leadership playbook, which is that he has unshackled Eddington and is like fucking around getting himself a cup of coffee and not taking a particular interest in their impending destruction at the hands of a couple of ticks, forcing Eddington to take the helm and use some fancy Maquis flying tricks to evade these two warships.
Cisco's managerial book isn't who moved my cheese. It's like, I'm going to go over here and get some ractogino while a couple of ticks descend on us.
Yeah.
He seems pretty chill.
It works, right? Like, Eddington starts the scene firm in the position that he's not going to take the helm. And then he's like doing donuts around plasma filaments and getting him out of there.
You can be an inspirational leader by stoking a person's self-preservation instinct.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing.
But he doesn't stop being a bad guy. And one of the ways he doesn't stop is that he insists that the way that they are going to get away from these ships is if Sisko rewires something with the impulse engines that is very, very dangerous to do if you're still using the impulse engines.
Eddington's like, have you ever heard of a culvert starburst? Sisko's like, that maneuver's been outlawed decades ago.
Presumptuous child playing on my ship.
Alamarain, come to Fort. Alamarain, come to Fort.
What are you doing?
Alamarain, come to Fort.
What are you doing? Alamarain, come to Fort. What are you doing now?
I would never have guessed that there was a Jeffries tube on a runabout.
It is super long, too.
Yeah.
It seems implausibly long.
Yeah, but also, I mean, we know that they're like bigger, like there's a whole back section and there may be a middle section even, right? Because they're...
Yeah, that Jeffries tube is longer than a banquet table, though. By a lot.
Yeah. No, it's a big, long Jeffries tube. What else can you access in there?
I don't know. It seems like a single-use Jeffries tube, and that's like a kitchen appliance.
Yeah.
You don't want one of those in your runabout.
Yeah, Alton Brown would disapprove of a Jeffries tube with only one use.
Yeah. Yeah, so Cisco's back there, like, disconnecting glow necklaces and then plugging them into another thing in there, and he's getting bangers just rain down on him.
Yeah, and some of these are Eddington, like, hitting potholes, and some of them are... the ticks firing upon them. But eventually...
I don't feel like Avery Brooks gets enough credit as a physical actor in a moment like this because he is full on like bouncing around inside the tube.
Yeah, it's good.
Good job by him.
Yeah. There's a fun moment after they've set the Praxis explosion off where Eddington is not receiving telemetry from Captain Sisko anymore. And assumes that he's home free, basically, that Sisko died down there in that tube. And Sisko grabs him from behind and roughs him up a little bit.
I told you to keep the ship steady.
You're alive. What a pleasant surprise.
Sisko's covered in Klingon coffee from this point forward.
Yeah. It probably smells nice, right?
Yeah.
I guess once it's brewed, coffee can smell a little funky.
Yeah.
It's the grounds that smell nice.
Yeah. Back on Deep Space Nine, we check back in on our B/C story where Jake and Nog are talking about roommate etiquette, W/R/T, dates coming over. Jake has had a lady friend over and Nog, I guess, walked in on them. But Nog doesn't think that it's a big deal because they were just talking. Just talking is what Jake wants him to think because... That's what you do. You hear the doorknob turn. You separate. You go to separate sides of the couch.
Yeah.
You look like you're talking, but you're not talking.
Yeah, you're not really
talking.
You
got your dick under the blanket.
Right.
That's what's happening.
They're getting close to achieving some resolution in this conversation when Nog clocks Martok and a couple of Klingons up on the second level in their spot, in the Jake and Nog babe-ogling spot.
He's like, this is the moment, man. I'm finally going to confront them.
You know, this aggression will not stand, man.
Yeah, that's our spot. And he takes it personally, like they're doing this at him.
Now who's being scurrilous?
So Nog goes up and confronts Martok and the other two guys. One of the Klingons looks not fully Klingon to me. Did you get that vibe? Klingon number 3 kind of had very soft, loafed features.
Oh, well, there's a lady Klingon with a boob window that has some fabric behind it, so you don't get any cleavage. And then there's another Klingon also.
Yeah.
Is that the one that you felt? Huh.
Yeah, kind of a strange looking Klingon. Anyway, I think the thing that we learn from this scene, I think is that comedy can get you out of mortal danger, because Nog is about to get his ass kicked, and what he does is he charms Martok into not kicking his ass.
Yeah. Nog coming up and flexing on these three is inherently funny, and they treat it as such. Like, and then they clear out to their credit.
I thought there was a chance that Nog would go over the railing here.
That would have been fun. But then he would have done that thing that a wide receiver does where he lands and then he gets back up on his feet without using his hands.
Yeah, I wonder if Nog takes a good bump. I bet he does.
Do you think Nog would do like a 3-point landing, like a superhero if he got thrown off that railing?
I don't get the sense that the cadet uniform is stretchy in a way that would allow that.
Mm.
Like, I think he'd blow out the crotch of that thing attempting to do it.
I mean, I would blow out the crotch if it meant I could do a cool 3-point landing.
What do you think a Ferengi hog looks like?
Like, it'd be like that Lenny Kravitz clip where his dong flopped out of his pants.
Are you're suggesting that Nog just has a massive crank?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I think he's shaved, and I think it's massive.
Whoa. All right. Kind of a lot of massive dongs on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, it's an above average workplace.
Kind of making me uncomfortable. Think about.
Well, Sisko and Eddington, having killed two entire ships full of Jem'Hadar, find the planet where these missiles were launched from, and it is a very smoky place. Apparently, the smoke has not cleared since these missiles were set off, and they're walking around in the Star Trek caves, and they see that they're not alone here. This place is full of Jem'Hadar.
I thought immediately that this was a setup, and I thought it was interesting that it almost immediately was not.
Yeah, Eddington is always using deception, so it's fun to try and predict what that deception will be, but I feel like this episode does a really good job of always having you picking the wrong cup to find the ball under.
She creeps and she crawls like a snake in the grass. Sometimes she's slow and sometimes she's fast.
Eddington hates the Cardassians so much that I couldn't remove the likelihood that he may be partnering with Jem'Hadar in order to double-cross them down the road, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But pretty soon they're in a firefight with these guys, Sisko is, like, beating them up with a pipe, and at this point it's full buddy cop. Like, Eddington and Sisko are saving each other's asses in these combat scenes, and they sort
Sisko of... Sisko is the hard pipe-hitting captain going to work on the Jem'Hadar here.
Yeah, and Eddington is the gimp.
Yeah. It is great. They are really Starsky and Hutch here.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
They fight their way through a lot of Jem'Hadar and eventually come to the room that Eddington says is going to be where the launch site is, and they go through, and it's not launch computers. It's a bunch of Maquis.
Maquis?
Who have been here being kept prisoner by the Jem'Hadar, and among them is the lady in the video on the iPhone that we saw at the beginning.
I wondered when you get here.
She's introduced as Rebecca Sullivan, and she is Michael Eddington's wife.
My wife.
Yuxamash.
We cut over to Sisko's face, and he's like, "You're married?" I mean, you're into literature, and you're so clean, and you wear that tight uniform. I mean, I had some assumptions. What?
You love show tunes.
Where were you when you learned that Eddington had a wife? That's what Sisko's experiencing here.
Morn, sweet morn.
Morn,
morn.
You here, buddy?
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
This was the deception. And
the deception was that he had a wife.
Yeah. And so they've got to escape. There's still tons of Jem'Hadar, but they're going to shoot their way out and get their way back to the runabout, because the missiles never existed.
I concur, sir.
Message is authentic.
No, the missiles are the people.
This was a coded message. The missiles were code for, we're on this planet in the Badlands, come get us. And it was enough to get Sisko to come spring Eddington from the Pokey and go get these people.
That is good news, but I still don't like being lied to.
And it's a double cross that's enough to earn you a punch in the face from Ben Sisko.
And then a side-by-side battling their way out because they shoot a lot of Jem'Hadar. I can't remember exactly where it is, but there's a moment where they come into a room and they like think that it's empty. And then Sisko just like walks into the middle and shoots everything. And a couple of Jem'Hadar are like invisible.
It's great.
Get killed.
That's before they unlock the door and find the Maquis inside. Yeah, that's an awesome scene.
That was dope. That was a great moment. Like, I've been waiting for something like that to happen in Star Trek.
Eddington almost immediately takes one to the chest. Yeah. And he's like, and he does that battlefield thing where he tells Sisko to just leave him behind so he can give covering fire to their escape. And this is something that Rebecca does not want to allow, because on the other end of the ladder, when Sisko tells Rebecca that he's back there, she wants to go. And he's like, nah, it's not going to happen. He's not coming.
The title, Blaze of Glory, you think is going to be about this Maquis missile plot to destroy millions of Cardassian lives as like one final act. And it's really about this moment with Eddington. He's going to bleed out while fighting, while holding off the Jem'Hadar to make good the escape of all of these other people.
You think the Blaze of Glory is under that cup, but it's really under this one over here.
Always a different blaze of glory than you think with this one.
Right.
Which is, I just think is great writing, you know, like very true to character.
We do see Eddington's death because he is filled up with weapons discharges.
Yeah.
And pretty blown away. And we rack into him and we hear his final word.
Rebecca.
And we cut to the runabout and hear the single brass instrument of treasonous heroism.
Yeah.
We actually like salute the guy. This is a show that is grieving the death of Eddington here.
Pretty wild stuff. And it feels impactful and earned. Like Sisko and Rebecca both get a close up, and it's clear that they're both regretting and dealing with this news in different ways.
Yeah. The actor who plays Rebecca is named Gretchen German, and she's not in any other Star Trek episodes, which I think makes her unique among guest stars on this show. But she does not get a ton to do, but I really like what she does with it in this episode.
Yeah, she brings a ton to a very brief role.
Yeah.
The twin buttons on the episode, a brief scene between Nog and Kira where Kira gets to observe Nog receiving a respectful interaction from Martok and being stunned that is a thing.
I don't know if this qualifies as something like a Pyrrhic victory, but like the one time that Nog isn't shoved into a locker is taken as a victory for him. But like Martok is on his way to steal his girlfriend or something. Like,
yeah.
I don't think anything is resolved here.
Yeah. I mean, Nog's always going to be Nog, right?
Yeah. The second button is in Sisko's quarters, and we start on a single of Dax, and we don't know who she's talking to until halfway through her comments.
Yeah.
But we realize toward the end of the scene that she's talking to Sisko, and she is positively nostalgic about Eddington and the way he went out.
Eddington couldn't have picked a better way to go.
She makes the case that his death was romantic somehow, and Sisko grudgingly agrees.
She's kind of making the case that they're two sides of the same coin and both big fans of a long shot or a lost cause.
Yeah. Kind of a game respect game appeal that she's making. I'm not sure if Sisko is willing to go all the way onto that side of the argument, but I think he notes it.
Dax is a fun character for kind of getting to getting to entertain somebody else's ethos because she's lived so long. Like she can kind of dip her toe in anybody's ideological waters without, you know, getting too wet. And it's fun to see her kind of force Sisko to look at it from a different angle than he might naturally do.
Speaking of entertaining, do you think Sisko brought Dax over to eat leftover calamari and slug sauce?
Doesn't keep for super long, you know?
I suspect the calamari didn't help.
That's a tough bargain. You have company over for leftover dinner.
Yeah. I discovered a bag full of leftovers from the restaurant that we ate at yesterday and got sick from in my car when I got home.
Oh, fuck. That's right. I put the wings in there.
Yeah. I threw it out today.
You know what? They probably weren't any more dangerous than they were at the time that they were served.
I don't think it was the wings that did it. I don't know what it is. I almost wonder if it's the nachos that did it, because there was a lot of fresh veg on the nachos, and that's usually where foodborne illnesses come from.
When we stopped for a restroom break, you picked up a couple of fizzy waters.
Yeah,
and that was an awesome thing to do. I didn't have mine, but I wonder if you soured your stomach on fizzy water and lukewarm nachos, like if that was the combination that did it.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe
sometimes
it was my fault.
Fizzy water doesn't agree with me.
Fuck me, right?
I am really trying to blame this whole situation on you. That's what I'm doing.
Did you like the episode, Adam?
I think whether or not you like this episode has to do with whether or not you like Eddington. I think Dax might as well be talking to you and me at the end when she's describing him. And if you're the Sisko in the room who's like, yeah, I can get with that, then I think you like the ep. And if you're like, fuck that guy, no, then maybe you don't. But I think I'm on team Respect Knuckles for Eddington. And I think it's a mistake to kill him off. I was reading some show notes about this episode, and there was an agreement in the writer's room that was like, you know, we're winding the show down soon. We only have a couple of seasons left, and this is one of those threads that could just go on forever unless we clip it. So let's clip it now. And I think that was a bad idea. Because there's no one like him in Star Trek. I think you got to leave that guy out there.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to bring him back if you don't want to, but why kill him?
It's interesting to imagine what would change about him in a world where humans are fighting for their existence at all against the Dominion and the Cardassians later on. You know, like he could start to be making the case that, like, I was in this fight long before the rest of you. Or he could, you know, switch sides in some interesting and weird way, like make some deal where they get to have their independent nation if they, you know, let the Cardassians stage attacks from the demilitarized zone. Like, there's so many interesting directions you could take Eddington.
Especially when the episode takes great pains in telling us that they aren't sure if the Maquis threat is over. Like, if you're going to allow the Maquis to exist as a thread that you don't clip, then why not let Eddington live? It's the same diff, right?
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, I do think things in life resolve, and this is a show that is, you know, more interested in, like, long-term consequences of things than previous editions of Star Trek. But also, like, eventually, like, stuff does go away. Like, stuff stops being a concern.
Right.
And maybe just a kind of clear headspace for that stuff. Like, I think that in a modern show, you wouldn't kill Eddington. And a lot of modern shows I have a problem with because it, like, it gets too hard to remember who's aligned with what and, like, who's, you know, like, whose team who's on and stuff. And I kind of think that I don't know. It works for me to get rid of him. Like I think he was a good villain for a long time, and I think maybe it's good to leave us wanting more with a character like this.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough.
Well, do you want to see if we have any Priority One messages in the old inbox?
Oh, I think we do.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, why don't you take that first one?
The message of a commercial nature.
Yay!
It goes like this. As a huge fan of the Ben and Adam Podiverse, I am reaching out to everyone who subs this one but does not listen to The Greatest Discovery to get the fuck on board.
Wow.
I literally have watched maybe two episodes of Disco, but the pod still works.
Wow.
And it's fantastic. Honestly, hey. Better than my experience with the show. Friendly Fire is also good, but I think I'm out of characters. Yeah, so this is a person who likes listening to The Greatest Discovery but does not watch Star Trek Discovery, or it sounds like any of the other CBS Star Trek properties.
Wow.
The call to action is subscribe to The Greatest Discovery and maybe Friendly Fire. I'm gonna edit that one a little bit, Ben, and say definitely listen to Friendly Fire as well. It's our hit war movie podcast.
Yeah.
That we do with John Roderick.
I think anybody that likes what we do on this show would like both of those other shows. And yeah, I mean, I hear from people that listen to Friendly Fire that don't watch the movies, and people that listen to this show that don't watch Star Trek at all and still enjoy the program. So give them a whiz. See if you like them.
I am blown away that someone used P1 money to advertise our shows on our show. So to whoever this is, thanks very much.
We have a second Priority One message here, also of a commercial nature. Goes like this. Greetings from Sweaty Alpha 5 and a beautiful place called Jim Shimoda. That's Jim with a G-Y-M. We are the Facebook fitness group inspired by a pun on a meme from the greatest podcast about Star Trek. Thank the prophets that Adam is so good at naming stuff. Otherwise, we'd be called something like the greatest burpee. And that sounds terrible. Why Jim Shimoda? Because exercise is the safest form of breath play. Our chill hangs also build muscle. And we just turned 2. Join us! So check out the Jim Shimoda group on Facebook.
If you are interested in a Priority One message of your own, you can go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where personal messages are $100 and commercial messages are $200, both of which are a way to get me very self-conscious about my pronunciation of S's for
yeah.
some reason. I'm having a little bit of a hard time for some reason.
What happened? What happened to you?
I don't know. I think one side of my face is getting numb. Anyway, MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. Get a priority one message and help with the ongoing production of this show.
And help Adam pay for his treatment for Bell's palsy.
Yeah.
Gotta get that gold press latch. Get that
gold press latch.
Am I right?
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Drunk Shimoda!
I kind of want to give an honorary Shimoda to Eddington here. It's the last time we're going to see him.
Just a lifetime achievement Shimoda?
Yeah, I think it's... it's not what the drunk Shimoda is for, necessarily. But we invented this technology. I think we can use it for whatever we want.
Yeah, are we going to use it for good or evil? That's the question we ask ourselves every week.
I think in this case, it depends on how you feel about Eddington.
Mm.
How about you, Ben?
I'm going to give it to the security guards. There are 2 security guards that work the room that Eddington is imprisoned in. It seems to be like a single suite jail cell. Like it's like you don't get the sense that there's like a big long row of cells with a bunch of different prisoners in them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it really looks like one little room with a cell and like a monitoring station. Two guards for Eddington. And these two guards are there while Sisko makes this pitch about, I need your help to stop a billion death war. These guys could not be less interested in what's going on around them. Like the guy at the station is like playing solitaire on his computer. He's totally ignoring this fucking breathless interaction between these two guys. And
that's got to be part of your job, right? You're listening to these types of conversations all the time.
They reminded me of the security guys in Star Trek III. Like,
yeah,
they are focused on being security guys, not on seeing what goes on with like some of the most famous people in the Federation.
Don't call me tiny.
Yeah, they're not starfuckers.
No. Every time I caught one of those guys in the background of one of these shots, I laughed because I just loved how much they didn't give a shit.
Good for them, keeping it professional.
Yeah. All right.
Well, this is a professional show that that teases the next episode in the series.
Yeah, we always...
Why don't we figure out what we're going to watch and how we're going to watch it?
Always selling the next episode. And next episode, of course, we'll be covering Season 5, Episode 24, Empaknor. O'Brien, Garrick, Nog, and a salvage team are stranded on a supposedly abandoned Cardassian space station.
Ooh.
It's not Terraknor, it's Empaknor.
I wonder if it's going to look the same.
Oh, you think they might build entirely new sets for this Star Trek thing?
No. I think I think the answer was in the question, huh?
Yeah. It's like that old Norm MacDonald joke. Lyle Lovett and Julia Roberts broke up because he's Lyle Lovett and she's Julia Roberts. The punchline is the setup.
Yep. Yep. Wow. Anytime we can fit a Norm MacDonald joke in the show, we got to do it. I'm glad we did.
Yeah.
Who's rolling the dice this time, Ben?
That would be you, my friend.
All right. Well, I've got those dice. And for the moment, our runabout is pulsing on square 30, where four squares ahead is a Measure of a Man episode. And two squares after that, it's a Kanar with Damar ep.
Oh, man.
That's the Invention of a Cocktail episode.
Yeah, we've never landed on that.
Hey, that's a fun one.
Folks, of course, can follow the Game of Buttholes, the Will of the Prophets, at gach.biz/game.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
Here comes the roll.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
And I have rolled a 5. That puts us right in the middle of those two squares I was talking about before.
Wow.
And means we will be doing a regular old episode.
Okay. Looking forward to reg-epping it with you, buddy.
Yeah, you and me both.
All right. Well, that'll be next week. In the meantime, go to MaximumFun.org/donate and contribute to the production of our show if you don't already. If you do already, thank you so much.
Yeah, you really keep us going. That's no joke.
Gotta thank our buddy Adam Ragusea, who makes all the original theme song stuff for the show. And of course, Dark Materia, upon whose Picard song all of that music is based.
For a long time, Adam Ragusea was a teacher, and now he's teaching us how to cook.
Yeah, teaching us how to cook real good on his YouTube show.
Yeah.
You search Adam Ragusea on YouTube.
Gotta thank friend of DeSoto, Bill Tilly, for making comic trading cards about every episode we do. You can find him on Twitter at BillTilly1973. And everywhere social media is found.
Yep. Use the hashtag GreatestGen to talk about the show. Adam's on Twitter at CutForTime. I'm on there at BenjaminAHR. There's a bunch of Facebook groups, Wikia about the show, Reddit sub. There's just a ton of great places to hang out with the friends of DeSoto. A delightful and truly sweet group of people. And we hope you go engage with them and get involved.
And with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which can't distinguish between two Cardassian space stations. But that doesn't make us a racist. You're Picard, you're Enterprise. Captain, you're
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Audience supported.